Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star, then zero on your touchtone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Senior Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you so much, Audra, and I too would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Connect Education Workshop updates from the 48th Annual San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium. And this is part one of Living with Breast Cancer updates from the 48th Annual San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium. And today's program is supported by an educational grant from Daiichi Sankyo, Novartis Oncology, and a grant from Genentech, and we really want to thank them for their support of today's program. Now, we have a lot of participants on the call today. There are over 343 participants. You come from all over the United States, and from both urban, rural, suburban, and frontier communities. And we also have a number of international participants from Canada, Colombia, France, Namibia, Nigeria, Tanzania, and the United Kingdom. So this is truly a global call. And again, this program is supported by an educational grant from Daiichi Sankyo, Novartis Oncology, and a grant from Genentech. And we really want to thank them for their support of today's program. And this is a very important program because it is a program that actually is reflecting on the San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium, and that's really important. I think people wait to hear this information from experts in the field. And now it is my great pleasure to introduce our first speaker, and our first speaker is Dr. Kate Lathrop, and Dr. Lathrop is Associate Professor, Division of Hematology and Oncology, UT Health San Antonio Breast Medical Oncology, Mays Cancer Center at UT Health San Antonio, Assistant Dean of Undergraduate Research, Long School of Medicine, UT Health San Antonio, Program Director, Medical Oncology and Hematology Fellowship Program, UT Health San Antonio, Program Director, San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium, or SABCS. And Dr. Lathrop will be addressing novel therapy for adjuvant hormone receptor positive breast cancer, antibody drug conjugates in first-line metastatic hormone receptor-positive breast cancer, and tailoring first-line therapy in metastatic HER2-positive breast cancer. It's really my great pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Lathrop.
Thank you so much for the kind introduction. I'm excited to get to chat with everybody on the call about some exciting research that was presented at SABCS this year. We had a great conference and some real potential changes to how we're going to be treating our cancer patients moving forward based on the research that was presented. So I want to go over three different clinical trials with you over about the next 15 minutes. So it'll be a little bit of a high overview, but I think these are really important because I think they're going to affect, you know, very soon how our patients are cared for. So the first place I want to start is actually in women that have early breast cancer, so stage 1, 2, or 3 breast cancer that's hormone receptor positive, also referred to as estrogen receptor positive. And this is the majority of our patients with breast cancer. They're early stage and they have hormone receptor positive breast cancer. So this could potentially apply to a very large number of patients. And this study is looking at a new medication called giredestrant, which is what's called a novel SERD. So this was the LIDERA study, and it was looking at adding a new novel SERD, again, giredestrant, to women after they've finished all of their initial therapy for their breast cancer. We call that part of the treatment adjuvant hormonal therapy. And since about 2000, that was the last time our therapies changed. So for about the last 25 years, we've been using the same set of medicines. These medicines include things like tamoxifen, or aromatase inhibitors. You may recognize them by names such as like anastrozole or letrozole or exemestane. And most women receive these medicines for at least 5 years, some women up to 7 or 10 years. So the Libera study was looking at using this new medicine, giredestrant, instead of these medicines like tamoxifen or aromatase inhibitor. So women either received those medicines or the new medication. And what they found was that women who received the giredestrant actually did better than the women who received either tamoxifen or an aromatase inhibitor. And what we were specifically looking at was whether the breast cancer returned. So we call that, it has a long name, it's called invasive disease-free survival, which means everybody's still alive and their cancer hasn't returned either, you know, in the breast area or somewhere else in the body. And if we looked at that over the period of time of this study, which was an average of about 30 months, so this is the first time the study is reporting, and we'll certainly get longer follow-up on these patients, which will be really important. But at least the initial finding is showing that if you were in the treatment group with the new medicine, there was a 92.4% of the patients were alive without recurrence of their breast cancer versus about 89.6% of the patients who received the older medicines, the standard medicines, tamoxifen or aromatase inhibitors. And that was a significant difference. And they also looked at something called overall survival. So obviously, if women are still alive for all reasons, and that data still needs to be collected for a longer period of time, but it looks like it's tending towards being in favor of giving this newer medicine. And then, of course, whenever we have a new medicine, we also like to make sure that we're not contributing to more toxicities, or that the toxicities are somewhat, you know, in balance with the benefits. And what we did find was that the toxicities of this medicine are fairly in line with what we know about for our other medicines that are in the group of medicines called aromatase inhibitors, again, things like anastrozole. Most common things were joint pain, hot flashes, fatigue, some insomnia. So we didn't see any significant new side effects to this medicine. So I think this is really going to set the stage for potentially changing options for women who are going to be receiving adjuvant therapy for estrogen receptor positive breast cancer. And how this fits in with our current treatment regimen is open for debate at the moment, because a lot of these women also receive medicines which are called CDK4/6 inhibitors. And while we have some safety data in the metastatic setting, those have not been tried in combination in the earlier adjuvant setting, but definitely an exciting trial for our patients. Moving on to the next trial, again, I'm going to stay in the hormone receptor positive or estrogen receptor positive group of patients, but instead of looking at patients with early disease, you know, stage 1, 2, or 3, we're now going to be looking at those patients who have developed metastatic hormone receptor positive breast cancer. And this trial is the ASCENT-07 trial. So this trial is looking at a medicine that we have a lot of experience with so far, but we're trying to see how it works earlier on. So the medicine we're talking about has a really long name. It's called sacituzumab govitecan. We call it SACSI for short. It is an antibody drug conjugate, which means that part of the molecule is designed to attach to a protein on the outside of the cancer cells. That protein is called TROP2 in this setting. And the other part of the molecule has what we call the cytotoxic payload, or the part of the medicine that actually kills the cancer cell. So these are new ways of developing, you know, they're kind of a newer form of targeted chemotherapy is an easy way to think about it. And we know that sacituzumab works in women with hormone receptor positive breast cancer that's metastatic after they've received medicines that try to affect the estrogen part of the cancer cell. So estrogen therapies like hormonal therapies with things like CDK4/6 inhibitors, and they have progressed, those women then move on to chemotherapy. So this study was looking to see if can we use these newer medicines, sacituzumab, right there, right when they no longer are good candidates for continuing to use endocrine therapy. And most of the studies with sacituzumab have been successful. They've shown that that medicine actually works better than our standard of care therapies. But this one was different. It was a surprise to a lot of us. It actually did not show that women who received sacituzumab instead of what was called physician's choice chemotherapy. So those are chemotherapies that are already approved for the use at this point in time. Things like capecitabine, paclitaxel, another medicine is called nab-paclitaxel. These are what's considered our standard of care treatments. And the women who received the standard of care chemotherapy medicines did actually a little bit better, just a little bit better than sacituzumab, as far as how long they stayed on the medicine before the cancer started growing again. If we look at overall survival, it actually looks like the women who received the sacituzumab maybe are doing a little bit better than the women who received standard of care chemotherapy. So I think that needs to be looked at longer. The longer we watch these women, we might develop a little bit more information. But I think it's important because, you know, sometimes we think of these studies as, you know, a failure, or we call them a negative study. But we know that there might be a group of women who really do benefit from having sacituzumab before we move on to other chemotherapy medicines. And the group of investigators who ran this clinical trial, their next task is to really dive into the data and look at individual patient characteristics and the characteristics of the patient's tumors to see maybe if we can predict who responds to this medicine better than another standard of care medicine. And that's really where we're moving a lot with our, you know, cancer treatments, obviously, is to try to select the patients that are going to be the best fit for individual medicines. And in this situation, I think there's going to be a lot of interest in looking at that protein that I talked about called TROP2, which is where this medicine, sacituzumab, actually binds or attaches to the cancer cells. And we may find out that for patients that have more of that on their cancer cells, it may matter in this particular situation. It may be a good way to select patients. So the last trial I'm going to talk about, we're going to stay in the metastatic setting. Also, we're going to stay in the hormone receptor or estrogen receptor positive patients. They can be. But all these patients were also HER2 positive. So this is the HER2CLIMB-05 clinical trial. And what this looked like, it was a phase 3 study of a medicine called ficatinib versus a placebo that was given in combination with two HER2-directed therapies called trastuzumab and pertuzumab as maintenance therapy for patients who have HER2-positive metastatic breast cancer. And I'm going to break that down a little bit because that's a mouthful. So this is looking at people who have just been diagnosed with HER2-positive breast cancer that is metastatic. And the current treatment is to give a combination of two antibodies to HER2, that's trastuzumab and pertuzumab, in addition to a chemotherapy backbone. Usually that chemotherapy is a medicine called a taxane. So we start off with chemotherapy, and then we move on and we just keep patients on maintenance therapy with trastuzumab and pertuzumab for as long as we can before they either develop toxicities to those medicines, although these ones are pretty well tolerated, Or what happens more often is that women develop a recurrence of their cancer, or a progression of their cancer. So this study looked at adding a third medicine, which is called tucatinib, to that maintenance part, so after the chemotherapy induction. And the main goal of this was to see whether tucatinib prevented progression of the cancer. And they also specifically looked at progression in the central nervous system or the brain, because for women with HER2-positive breast cancer, one of the things we're very concerned about is the development of metastasis or spread of the cancer to the brain. And often that is the most serious complication for women who have HER2-positive breast cancer. So this study actually did allow women who had metastasis to the brain to be on the clinical trial, and they are looking at those patients, although it is a small amount of patients. So the take-home message here is that tucatinib did improve how long women were able to stay on the medicine before the cancer grew. So if for the women who were receiving Herceptin and Perjeta with tucatinib, their average time on treatment was about 25 months versus the women who did not receive tucatinib, their average time on treatment was about 16 months. So the difference was about 5.5 months longer if you received the tucatinib. They also saw a little bit of a benefit as far as how long women lived overall, but still that they need more time to gather data and watch women on the trial before they're able to confirm that. And then importantly, that small group of women who, when they came onto the clinical trial, had evidence of disease already in the brain, women who received the tucatinib, they were able to have stability of their cancer for 4.2 months longer than women who did not receive that. And then again, whenever we're adding additional drugs, we want to look at toxicity because every drug has side effects. And so for women who received the tucatinib, there was a little bit more diarrhea and there was a little bit more nausea. There's a little bit more increase in some of the inflammation in the liver. But overall, the investigators thought that the toxicities with the addition of tucatinib were manageable. So this has become an option for women who have metastatic HER2-positive breast cancer, regardless of whether they're also estrogen receptor positive or not. And this is an area where we're getting a lot more potential therapies that we can give to patients. So it's an opportunity to really try to individualize our treatment for women with HER2-positive metastatic breast cancer at the very beginning of their treatment for that. And with that, I'm going to go ahead and conclude.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Lathrop. That was just an outstanding, stellar presentation and really provided people with really a lot of hope about some of the newer treatments that are available to them. And so I know there'll be more questions for you during the Q&A as well. Thank you so much. And our next speaker is Dr. Kamal Abu Hussein. Dr. Hussein is Assistant Professor of Medicine, Cooper Medical School, Rowan University, Adjunct Assistant Professor, Department of Breast Medical Oncology, MD Anderson Cancer Center, Co-Director of the Janet Knowles Breast Cancer Program, Director of the Breast Cancer Clinical Trials, MD Anderson Cancer Center at Cooper. And Dr. Hussein will be addressing integration and sequencing of novel oral selective estrogen receptor degraders, or SERDs, in metastatic hormone receptor positive breast cancer and de-escalating therapy in low-risk ductal carcinoma in situ, DCIS. It's really my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Hussein.
Thank you so much, Dr. Mesner, for the nice introduction, and I'm pleased to be here with everyone, and pleased to follow Dr. Lathrop for the very nice presentation. And as she mentioned in the first trial that she alluded to, I'm going to be focusing also on three different studies. Two out of the three are going to use agents that belong to the same class like the LIDERA trial, which is the first trial that we heard from Dr. Lathrop about, for the giredestrant, which is an oral SERD. Again, those two trials are going to be focusing on similar drugs from the same family. And those are going to be studied here in those trials in the advanced or metastatic setting. So the first trial is the EMBER-3 trial. And this is a trial that looked at patients who are having metastatic hormone receptor positive, HER2-negative breast cancer. And they developed disease progression following treatment with aromatase inhibitors with or without CDK4/6 inhibitors. And here they had three different arms for that trial. One arm was a monotherapy of a new oral SERD called imlunestrant. And the second arm is the same drug, imlunestrant, in addition to abemaciclib. And the third arm is a standard of care endocrine therapy, which could have been fulvestrant or exemestane. And the questions that they were trying to answer here is, how does imlunestrant versus the standard endocrine therapy perform in this ER-positive breast cancer who have an ESR1 mutation? And this is an important mutation that patients, when they are treated previously with aromatase inhibitors, drugs like letrozole, anastrozole, and exemestane, they can acquire this mutation and develop it over time and become resistant to such treatment. The second question they were trying to answer is, what about an end result called progression-free survival across all the participants in the trial? And the progression-free survival means the length of time that a metastatic breast cancer patient lives without disease progression. And does combining imlunestrant and abemaciclib add benefit to the monotherapy imlunestrant? And then they looked at other things like overall survival and important endpoints like delaying the time to starting chemotherapy and safety of the drug. And here we've seen some updated results in San Antonio where the progression-free survival in the ESR1 mutated population did improve from 3.8 months in the typical endocrine therapy to 5.5 months with imlunestrant. We've seen also that the overall survival benefit was noted with a numerical improvement of more than 11 months, even though it did not meet the criteria for being statistically significant, but still it is a meaningful numerical improvement. And then when they looked at all the participants, regardless of whether they had ESR1 mutation or not, they did see almost doubling of this progression-free survival. And then they looked at patients who were treated with CDK4/6 inhibitors. And in those patients who were adequately treated, we saw that the progression-free survival improved from a little over 3 months to more than 9 months. And the overall survival benefit was noted. There was a favorable trend in the trial. Now, they looked at other features. So cancers can harbor other mutations that are important. So in about 40% of our metastatic patients, we can see a mutation called PIK3CA mutation. So patients who had this PI3K mutation, they looked at whether they can benefit from such a drug, and they did see an improvement from the addition of abemaciclib to imlunestrant compared to imlunestrant alone, actually doubling of the progression-free survival, and again, close to doubling of the progression-free survival in the patients that did not carry that mutation. So basically, you are seeing a consistent benefit of abemaciclib and imlunestrant that was maintained regardless of whether you have the PI3K pathway mutation or not. Then there is a smaller number of patients that co-express mutations like ESR1 and PIK3CA. And in this trial, there was a nice number of patients, about a fifth of the patients, about 20%, that co-expressed those mutations. And gladly, we were able to see that there is a significant improvement in progression-free survival from about 5.5 months to about 12 months. So you can see a consistent benefit, really. And they looked at the time to chemotherapy, and that is a meaningful, clinically meaningful endpoint to our patient, which is how long can we keep them off of chemotherapy. which comes with a higher degree of side effects. And we've seen that patients who had this ESR1 mutation did have a 5 months benefit from using the combination. And then they compared patients who had the imlunestrant versus the combination, and they saw that this was a consistent benefit with a significant improvement. The last endpoint they measured here is something called progression-free survival 2, which is the time to the second progression, and also that was improved. So all in all, we did see very positive results, and no new safety concerns were reported from that trial. So what does that mean to you as a patient or a patient advocate? I think the way that I understand it is patients with ESR1 mutated tumors, which is an acquired mutation, now have an effective oral option, which is imlunestrant, that improves the length of time that we are able to tolerate their disease, and a positive trend to overall survival. And patients with heavy prior treatments, including CDK4/6 inhibitors, we've seen that the combination of imlunestrant and abemaciclib offers a stronger disease control and delays the need for chemotherapy. And these results support this possibly all oral chemotherapy-free strategies that hopefully can maintain quality of life, which is an important consideration when we are designing trials that are patient-centric or focusing on the quality of life. And as the follow-up matures, hopefully we will get more data on survival, more data on long-term side effects, and more long-term outcomes will emerge. The same agent is being studied in the early stage setting, a very similar trial to the lidERA trial that was alluded to earlier, called the EMBER-4 trial. And we're seeing this model of treating patients with 2 to 5 years of hormonal therapy, typical hormonal therapy, maybe with an aromatase inhibitor and a CDK, and then switching patients to either continuing on the standard of care hormonal therapy or being on an oral SERD, done in more than one trial, including this EMBER-4 trial and another trial called ELEGANT trial, using drugs from the same family. Now, I would like to switch gears a little bit and talk about a second trial that also focused on another oral SERD. This time, the oral SERD is called giredestrant, the same one that was used in the lidERA trial, but here in the second line, after progression on prior endocrine therapy and CDK4/6 inhibitors. And here patients were randomized to either receiving this oral SERD, giredestrant, in addition to everolimus, which is an mTOR inhibitor, a drug that we have been using for a long period of time, compared to endocrine therapy, which could be fulvestrant, exemestane, or tamoxifen in combination with the same drug, everolimus. So this is important because this combination targets two signaling pathways. One of them is the estrogen receptor pathway, and the other pathway is often referred to as PAM. PAM stands for PI3K AKT mTOR pathway. And those are associated with endocrine therapy-related resistance. So on this trial here, they took those two arms and they tried to answer the questions, can we improve progression-free survival in patients who have this ESR1 mutation and in the overall population with the addition of this oral drug, giredestrant. And we've seen some biomarker updates from the San Antonio Symposium with a significant progression-free survival benefit from the addition of giredestrant. And we've seen here the ESR1 mutant population saw more than 60% reduction in risk of progression. The overall survival data was immature, but overall favorable in the ESR1 mutated population and in the whole population. Again, as we mentioned before, the PIK3CA mutation, the AKT mutation, P10 mutations, lots of mutations that we keep looking for in testing of genomic testing called NGS testing that we try to analyze the cancer cells and see if there are any targetable mutations. And here those usually present opportunities for targeted therapies, but they can also be associated with a diminished prognosis or overall prognosis for patients that harbor them if not treated with the right medicines. So here, when they looked at patients that had such alterations or mutations, they saw a consistent progression-free survival benefit across patients who harbored those mutations. We've seen other trials from before showing us that if you responded to the first-line therapy with a CDK4/6 inhibitor less than a year, you're less likely to develop a or to get a meaningful benefit. And so here they looked at the duration of response on prior therapy with a CDK, and actually everybody seemed to derive benefit from this approach of giredestrant and everolimus, even patients that progressed quickly on their first line in less than 12 months. They looked at the different types of the CDK4/6 inhibitors, whether they used palbociclib, ribociclib, and abemaciclib, and the benefit was seen in all three drugs. So basically, we are seeing lots of improvement in the endpoints, whether it is progression-free survival, by all the different categories of whether you were treated with a CDK, whether you have prior mutations, and also an improvement in response rate, and more than that, an improvement in the duration of response in both the mutated population and in the wild-type populations. So really, very reassuring data. And again, at the end of every trial, I ask myself, what does that mean for our patients? So it means that regardless of whether you have an ESR1 or a PIK3CA pathway mutation, this combination of giredestrant and everolimus significantly delays disease progression compared to standard of care endocrine therapy. And patients who developed disease progression on a prior CDK still derive benefit from such combination. And again, this is a fully oral combination, chemotherapy-free combination that is overall relatively well tolerated. So moving on to the last study that I would like to allude to, and this one is far away from oral SERDs, and we're focusing here on DCIS, hormone receptor positive DCIS, which is ductal carcinoma in situ, usually referred to as stage zero breast cancer. And this trial is called the Loretta trial, and here they tried to answer whether tamoxifen alone, without surgery, could effectively treat women with low-risk hormone receptor positive DCIS. So again, DCIS is a non-invasive form of breast cancer that is often treated with surgery. And here we're trying to explore a different approach. So who took part in this study? It was women between the age of 40 to 75 years of age. They had to have hormone receptor positive DCIS, defined as at least estrogen receptor positivity more than 10%, HER2 negative, and they had to have low-risk disease, so grade 1, grade 2, and the cancer size on the scan, whether it's a mammogram, ultrasound, or an MRI, was less than 2.5 centimeters. And, of course, there's no invasive cancer present in the biopsy. The treatments that they received is standard dose tamoxifen at 20 milligrams daily, and that was taken for up to 5 years. And there was no initial surgery. So surgery was only offered if needed later due to progression of disease. And the main goals here is they tried to monitor for the rate of invasive breast cancer development in the same side or the same breast over the course of the 5 years. And they set a safety limit of no more than 7%. So this means if the development of invasive cancer on the same side is above 7% in the five-year period, then that is an unacceptably high rate. They included more than 340 patients, and the study review was reported after about 3 years of follow-up, and really that showed that the five-year invasive cancer risk was about 9.8%. So above the 7% safety threshold. And that led to early stopping of the trial. But there are lessons to be learned here from this trial. This is a trial where surgery was not used as a modality, and we've seen here an 82% of the participants that remain surgery-free at 5 years. We've seen that, as we mentioned, it's only 9.7% patients that eventually had surgery because of disease progression. And the overall survival was 98.8% at 5 years. So no deaths due to breast cancer. And the meaning of such a trial for patients is probably tamoxifen-only therapy can allow some patients to avoid surgery, at least temporarily, but it came with a higher than expected risk. So there is a probably 1 in 10 risk of progressing to invasive cancer. And so close monitoring with annual mammograms, possibly MRIs, regular visits is essential. And the trial deepens our understanding, but surgery remains the standard of care for most women with DCIS. You know, there are ongoing trials. There are trials that have results from before that showed no difference early on, like the COMET trial that we're still following up for more mature results. But there are ongoing trials. There are two other trials, including GLORIS and LORD, that are exploring active surveillance with and without hormonal therapy for low-risk DCIS. And as research evolves, individualized decisions based on the biology of the tumor, the overall health of the patient, and the personal preferences really will eventually guide care. At this point, I will stop, and back to you, Dr. Messon.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Hussain. That was just a stellar, just an excellent presentation, a lot of wonderful information, new information that many of our participants are not aware of, and so we really appreciate this presentation. I know there will be lots of questions for you during the Q&A as well. Thank you so much. And I'm just going to say a few words about the services of cancer care. So cancer care is offers free national programs and services throughout the United States. We have a HOPE line that anyone can call Monday through Friday, Eastern Time, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m., and our website, www.cancercare.org. And our website offers a whole range of programs, from online support groups to financial assistance to practical assistance to co-payment assistance. We also offer a pet assistance program for people who have a cat or a dog and that they're not able to care for them because of their illness. We help to pay for those costs. And we also help with food insecurity and with just practical things that people need. And we also have a lot of different support groups that are available online that you can access for both caregivers and for people living with many different types of cancer. And now we're going to move on to the Q&A, and I'm going to ask Audra to explain to you how to queue up for questions. Audra?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, we will take questions from the web only. You may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question. Dr. Messner?
Okay. Thank you so much. We have a question from one of our participants, and this one would go to Dr. Lathrop. As a cancer survivor, should I get a test like Galleri that screens for 50 plus cancers? It just got FDA approval.
So great question. I'm going to stick within the breast cancer realm on this one. Right now, we do not have good evidence that liquid-based biopsies, which is where you would take a blood draw or sometimes even a large amount of blood, almost like you're donating blood, which is called apheresis. Looking for circulating tumor cell DNA or RNA or circulating tumor cells, there's different assays. Right now, we don't have any evidence that really helps impact things like how long women live if they're diagnosed with breast cancer. Unfortunately, right now, some of those assays can have a very high negative predictive value, meaning that if they are negative, you probably don't have cancer, but the positive predictive value, meaning that you were able to find a cancer that's there, is a little bit low for us. And so until we have more data, I would not suggest doing those tests outside of a clinical trial. I think if you are on a clinical trial, it's very reasonable because you have people who are going to be watching you and making sure that we interpret that data within the setting of a clinical trial and that you're still getting all of your proper cancer screening. I would not replace any of those tests for our evidence-based cancer screening that's based on age and some risk factors that has been proven for, many years to be successful in decreasing mortality from breast cancer, and that's screening mammography.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And another question for Dr. Hussain. How should a patient with stage 3 lobular cancer who had bilaterals be followed for recurrence?
So that's a great question. And lobular cancer has some differences compared to the most common subtype of breast cancer, which is the invasive ductal. And lobular cancer is a cancer that does not show itself very well on breast imaging. For example, it has some unique areas of spread that is a little different than ductal cancer. However, the recommendations for follow-up and for monitoring or surveillance is really the same. So standardized treatments in the adjuvant setting or the post-operative setting is based off of the risk factors for both invasive ductal and invasive lobular cancers. We do have trials that intensify the endocrine or the hormonal-based therapy, like the Monarchy and Natalie trial that included adjuvant use of CDK4/6 inhibitors for 2 or 3 years. For patients with high risk, we have trials like the LADIRA trial that Dr. Lathrop alluded to earlier that looked at patients with intermediate and high risk hormone receptor positive breast cancer, and those would apply to both subtypes of breast cancer, the IDC or invasive ductal and invasive lobular. Not aware that it is a standard of care right now to do any additional testing other than follow-up exams, reporting any new concerning symptoms to the oncologist who is following the patient. There's definitely a lot of excitement about the use of ctDNA for monitoring patients with high-risk disease. However, I try not to do that outside the realm of a clinical trial for the time being, but hopefully that's going to change in the near future, and we'll be able to detect molecular recurrence before we see recurrences on scans, radiographic recurrence.
Thank you so much. And question for Dr. Lathrop. Has there been any research on best practices for low hormone-positive breast cancer, such as 10% progesterone and 0% estrogen during the maintenance phase of treatment?
I think the question might be about supplemental can you read the question again for me? I just want to make sure.
Yes.
I understand it.
Has there been any research on best practices for low hormone positive breast cancer, such as 10% progesterone and 0% estrogen during the maintenance phase of treatment?
Got it. Okay. Yeah. So the question here is how much receptor positivity means you're positive, right? So when we get a pathology report back, it'll say estrogen receptor positive, and it'll give a percentage, meaning those that if the pathologist is looking at that tumor under the microscope, what percent of cells are expressing either the estrogen receptor or the progesterone receptor. There's different cutoffs. They're usually either 5% or 10%. I would say most oncologists really will feel like if the estrogen receptor expression is under 10%, while there's really probably no harm to giving hormone-directed therapy like tamoxifen or aromatase inhibitors, there's also probably a lot less benefit, and that cancer is going to probably act more like a hormone receptor negative breast cancer than it's going to act like a hormone receptor positive breast cancer. If I had a patient come to me with estrogen receptor, which was zero, and the progesterone receptor was just 10%, I would treat that patient as hormone receptor negative and focus more on if they're HER2 positive, that you treat them that way. And otherwise, I would focus more on treatment as a triple negative.
Excellent. Thank you. For Dr. Hussain, how is breast cancer research being modified to be more inclusive? Are there any clinical trials specific to people of color?
Well, that's actually a great question, and it is something that we as a field strive for. Representation of patients from different backgrounds, different ethnicities, because it is acknowledged that the results when any large clinical trial has a majority of patients who are Caucasian or white, it's really hard to apply the same results to different ethnicities, whether we're talking about the African American population, Asian population, and other less represented populations in clinical trials. So it is something that is a main focus for a lot of clinical trials. I'm happy to see that this becomes a lot more exciting when they include a site that has a more diverse population. And I will use, for example, we talk about the oral SERD trials, and we talk about intensifying oral SERD as a modality in high-risk patients in the adjuvant setting. And an example is the trial, the EMBER-4 trial, which is a very large trial, about 8,000 patients. And I think one of the things that we discussed during the San Antonio conference is how come this does not have any sites in Africa? How come that does not really open in all the different parts in an equitable way, and it is a concern, but it's a work in progress, and I'm happy that this is at least being acknowledged and worked hard at including everyone in clinical trials these days.
Excellent. Thank you so much. Thank you. It's a great question and a great answer. Thank you. Another question for Dr. Weisrup. What do you attribute to the increase in younger women being diagnosed with breast cancer, never having a child, having the first child after age 35, using an IUD which emits hormones?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's a great question. And we did look at one of the themes this year in San Antonio as far as the education sessions was really trying to look into the increasing rate of diagnosis of breast cancer in our young women. And I it's complicated, and there's not just one thing that's contributing to the increased risk of breast cancer. Certainly probably some environmental factors, certainly increased risk of incidence of obesity in our populations. So for an individual woman, it's multifactorial. We traditionally know that the more estrogen exposure a woman has during their lifetime does tend to increase risk of breast cancer. So that would be, starting menarche or starting menstrual periods earlier on, going through menopause or stopping menstrual periods later. And there are some women in certain combinations of estrogen exposure for hormone replacement therapy that might increase the risk. There's others that might decrease the risk. So, there's lots of factors that go into that, and it's it's not a one size fits everybody kind of picture, unfortunately. So it's much more complicated than that.
Thank you so much. And I think it's a good time for us to have takeaways from our speakers. So I'm going to ask Dr. Lathrop if she'd like to provide a takeaway from today's program.
Yeah, well, my first takeaway is I appreciate the large interest in everybody taking their time to listen to us and be interested in the science that's being presented at San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium. If you're interested in advocacy, we have a wonderful advocacy program that's run by the Alma Breast Cancer Foundation. That might be something you would be interested in if you're interested in learning more about breast cancer and helping the breast cancer community. But it's exciting that, you know, every year we keep moving diligently along in discovery, and, you know, the overall goal is to decrease the burden of this disease globally. So it's an honor to get to speak with all of you. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you. And Dr. Hussain?
I think I echo the same sentiments, and I really appreciate everybody who's taking the time and caring enough to attend such sessions. But as usual, San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium provides the best information that we get throughout the entire year for breast cancer updates. And I think one of the strongest messages from this year's San Antonio is that breast cancer treatment is becoming more precise and more personal. So we're seeing a lot of trials that are addressing details that are working to better match the right treatment to the right person, so that many patients hopefully can get enough treatment to be effective without more than what they actually need. And the same time, we're seeing this steady progress in new options for harder to treat breast cancers, which mean more choices and hopefully more hope, even a few years ago in comparison.
Oh, thank you so much. I want to thank both of our speakers. You've been phenomenal. I want to thank all of our participants as well for asking such really great questions. We weren't able to take all of your questions, so I do want to comment on that. If you had the chance to ask a question, please also go back to your treating healthcare team and ask them the same question. And if you didn't have a chance to ask your question, again, go back to your treating healthcare team and ask your question. We've learned over many of these programs that people are kind of really not always asking the questions that they would like to ask of their healthcare team. So please always ask your questions of your healthcare team as well, because remember, they have your medical records, they have everything about you, and they're and best able to answer your question in addition to the answers you get on the program today. Also, we have discovered that there are certain times when it's hard to get your healthcare team. Seems to be weekends, evenings, and holidays. So be sure to ask your healthcare team who's available weekends, holidays, and weekends, because that really seems to be a big challenge for all of you on the call today. And again, I want to thank you all for your participation today. I want to thank you for being on the call today, and we look forward to our next program, which will be on, we're going to do part two of San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium. So you'll be hearing more in January about that and many of our other programs that we're doing. So again, thank you so much, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Thank you.
And ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may now disconnect. Everyone, have a great day.